Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Daniel Paris, host of the New Books in Finance podcast, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted today to have as my guest Mihir Desai, the author of The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. Professor Desai is a joint appointment of the Harvard Business School and Harvard Law School, and he is in this book does something which I think is really wonderful and interesting, which is an effort to prevent finance, not as a matter of secret formulas that can be perceived as stripping people of their money or Wall Street hijinks or incomprehensible graduate school algorithms and spreadsheets, but seen as everyday decisions through the prism of the humanities as a way of understanding and navigating life for all. The Wisdom of Finance, in my opinion, the book bridges the gap between what are often assumed to be two alien worlds, unable to communicate or understand one another. And as a historian of the humanities who happened to end up in finance, I, in particular, I'm very sympathetic to this cause. Welcome, Mihir Desai.
Thanks so much, Daniel. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. Let's start with a few of the most important concepts that you bring up in your book. And you use the book to hit four or five of the key finance constructs. So one of the early ones is caught in a nice phrase where an individual says in one of the pages that we are all an insurance company. A life is an insurance company. One of the characters as an intro into the topic of risk and probability, which is a central construct of modern finance. Could you elaborate on that notion?
Sure. You know, that chapter and that idea is, I think, representative of the book, which, as you mentioned, is an effort to demystify and rehabilitate finance by connecting the big ideas of finance to philosophy, literature, and history. So in that particular chapter and that particular quote, which is, you know, we are all insurance companies, I like that quote a lot because it connects two worlds that people just would never connect, right? So most people think insurance is boring and very dry and not connected to their humanity at all. And in that chapter, I really try to suggest that they're, you know, deeply connected. And to do that, there's a couple of stories in there that are worth just visiting quickly. And then I'll talk to you about the person who said, we are all insurance companies. The chapter begins with a story from Dashiell Hammett, which is in fact all about insurance. It's from the Maltese Falcon, but actually has some really big insurance ideas in it. And then I tell the story of this philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, who's a really, you know, remarkable man. He's the kind of intellect that we don't see anymore. He was a geographer. He was a semiotician. He was a philosopher. He was the founder of the Most American School of Philosophy, which is pragmatism. And the story goes that he was a little bit down on his luck, and he had been kind of cast out of the academy for behaving badly. And William James, another famous American philosopher, wrote to him and said, you should come back to Harvard and actually give a talk about your philosophy. And people were suspicious because he had been a little bit of a drunk and a little bit down on his luck. And so Charles Peirce shows up, and in his first lecture, he goes on to propound that we are all insurance companies. And he actually uses some calculus to derive the first order conditions for pricing insurance contracts, which does not go over well. And many people in the room think he's drunk, actually. He was getting to, though, a deep truth, which is we are all insurance companies. And what he meant, of course, is that the key to life is not introspection, but it is to gain experience. And that is the essence of pragmatism. And so what he was getting at was this idea that in order to live a full life, you have to do what insurance companies do, which is you have to go out and experience the world. And that experience will teach you about the way the world works, the probabilities by which events happen. And that's the only way in some ways to live, which is to actually go out and experience the world. It's like a very American way of thinking about philosophy. No navel gazing, no introspection, but just experience the world.
A little bit of the Nike, just do it.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was a really fun way to kind of connect two worlds. And in that chapter, I also use Wallace Stevens, who is a great American poet, maybe the best of the last century. But many people don't know he was also an insurance company executive. And he spent his whole career in insurance. And, you know, all his fellow poets kind of made fun of him because they thought it was very bourgeois and kind of nerdy to do. But he understood that he was working at the Hartford and at night he was writing poetry and people around him thought he was crazy. But he understood that those two worlds were really deeply connected, that they were both, for him, ways of making sense of the chaos of the world. So I really wanted in that chapter to kind of give this intuition of insurance, which is not about, you know, stochastic calculus or something very dry, but, you know, about the fundamental problem of life, which is confronting uncertainty and dealing with it by experience and using probabilities to think through these problems. And that, I thought, was a really interesting way to kind of convey that. So the chapter kind of goes through the history of insurance, but the really interesting stories to my mind are the one from the Maltese Falcon, this purse story, and then Wallace Stevens, who kind of connects insurance to poetry in kind of this incredible way.
Indeed, I agree. And in my world, there's also the language of decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. And this is another way of kind of getting at that. You know, that's the common choice that we make in the investment world is trying to make those decisions. And I thought the Dashiell Hammett story was and the Wallace Stevens story was an excellent. I did not know that he worked at the Hartford. I've every time I will look at that company, I will keep that in mind.
Well, I think your point about investing being about decision-making under uncertainty, I mean, at some very general level, a lot of life is that, right? And it is about, in a world of limited information and of uncertainty, how do you make decisions? And that is like the core of finance, you know, very much the core of finance.
Indeed. And within that also, you know, sort of the within the framework of decision making under conditions of uncertainty is risk management. And, you know, our lives are not controlled studies, double blind studies. We just don't know. We have to make decisions who to marry and so forth, colleges, jobs, where to live based on the best information that we have. You have a wonderful section on risk management through the concept of marriage in a literary context. And I am an enormous Jane Austen fan, particularly Pride and Prejudice. And I consider myself very, very familiar with both the work and the kind of the secondary literature about it. But I, in my life, have never come across the phrase that Lizzie Bennet had hit the bid. Can you explain what that means? That made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, sure. No, so I think, you know, once you kind of open up this world of uncertainty, and insurance, of course, is one way of dealing with it, you know, which is pooling of risks. But much of finance is about how to deal with those kinds of risks more generally. And of course, options and diversification are two of the big ones. So, you know, again, rather than try to introduce this with Black-Scholes Merton or whatever you want to think about doing, I go back to, you know, Jane Austen, and I use her because in many ways her novels are fundamentally, you know, about risk management. And in particular, a number of her female heroines have a big risk management problem. And, you know, Austen is clear about this when she says young women cannot make mistakes. Young men can make mistakes, but it's very costly for young women to make mistakes. And of course, what she's getting at is this kind of the marriage market and how you kind of take these suitors. And in essence, Pride and Prejudice with Lizzie and a number of her other novels, you have these young women who, you know, suitors come along. Some of them are, very wealthy but drunk. Some of them are nice but ugly. And, you know, there's always this, you know, this set of trade-offs. And of course, Mr. Collins's proposal to Lizzie is, I think, just fantastic because it really is an example of somebody trying to play off the risk aversion of
For those of you not familiar with it, his proposal to Lizzie is one of the finest and most unromantic statements, but it is a pure, almost finance proposal of marriage.
Right, right. It is, you know, in short, it is, you know, you're not that pretty, you're not that wealthy. So here's an offer on the table. I suggest you take it. And of course, his and her mother says you should take it as well because of the riskiness of this market. Of course, Lizzie consults her father and then and says no, and then and goes on to roll the dice again. And of course, finally finds Mr. Darcy. And that is a fantastic ending to that story. The neat part of that is not just that there are these risk management problems, but in these novels, you'll hear these characters providing the intuitions behind these really important risk management tools like options and diversification. So I use Anthony Trollope's, you know, Phineas Finn as an example of this wonderful character, Violet Effingham, who basically gives voice to the logic of diversification and options when she's talking about which one of 10 suitors, you know, she should marry.
Let's stop on that just because, again, I think in the popular opinion, and particularly for many of the people who might be listening here, an option is not certain what it is, but they're pretty certain it's bad. So let's stop, you know, back up just a little bit and explain for the general audience what financial options are and then how you're applying that to seeing them in literary characters.
Sure. So a financial option is this kind of it is maligned in the general press, but it is kind of a remarkable financial instrument. It is the right to buy something or sell something as opposed to actually owning something. So you have the right to own it as opposed to actually owning it. And because it's just a right, it's kind of magical in that when things go your way, you can buy it at that predetermined price and benefit from it having gone up. But if in fact it went down, you didn't have to buy it because it's only a right. It's not an obligation to buy. And so an option is the right to do something in essence. And, you know, that turns out to be a powerful way to think about the world. In the Violet Effingham case, she talks about diversification by, you know, basically saying, I wish I could marry all 10 of the suitors, which of course is the essence of diversification. And then she outlines an option portfolio strategy, which is basically acquiring a bunch of these options and then, you know, deciding which one at some point when she's ready to, you know, hit the strike price, as it were. But optionality is such a pervasive way of thinking about the world for people in finance. And I'm sure you know this, which is I hear young people talking about optionality all the time, which is they want optionality in their life, which is they want more choices. In fact, what I try to write about in the book, and I do this via Bartleby the Scrivener, as well as Seize the Day by Saul Bellow, that kind of thirst for optionality actually can end up being kind of corrosive. And this is what I see in young people today, which is they're so hungry for optionality in their life that what I actually observe happening to them is something quite sad, which is as young people, they get so obsessed with optionality, and that can mean, you know, getting a degree to get a, or getting, going to the right firm in order to create more options in the future, or go to the right school to create more options in the future. They get so obsessed with that way of thinking about the world that they forget that the real lesson of options is you should take big risks. And people who consume options for their whole young part of their life only get good at one thing, which is buying more and more options. So it's a very kind of, in a way, ironic way that people who love optionality in finance mislearn the most important lesson.
Yeah, life is lived while you're making other plans. And if you're constantly just gaming the system rather than actually doing something, you've lost out on time.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is, I think that's represented in some ways of the book generally, which is there's this idea, optionality, which is kind of brought forward in this literary vein. Go through a little bit of the history. You know, option contracts didn't show up in the 1960s or 70s or with the financial crisis. They've been going on for thousands of years. And then talk about how that idea kind of refracts on your life in maybe a slightly more complex way, which is people think life is all about acquiring optionality, but in fact, that's both a misreading of the lesson in finance, but also not a terribly good way to live, where I see these young people who just get good at only one thing, which is buying more and more optionality.
I think I heard, just as a distraction or an outtake, I think I heard one of your terminal values in the background. Can you explain how one, in a somewhat extreme fashion, could refer to your children as a terminal value? And it's a wonderful way of, you know, how you know you live for your children at a certain point. But explain that in finance terms, if you can.
Yeah, sure. So I think, indeed, that was one of them. So, you know, these terminal values are these really important devices in finance, which is whenever we value companies, you know, the first thing that many people outside of finance don't understand, although, you know, you and some of your listeners would understand, which is we only care about the future, right? So when you think about valuing a company, you don't look backwards. You look to the cash flows that they'll generate into the future. That's like one of the most important principles in finance. And it turns out that when we do these valuations, we often end up using these terminal values. So you kind of think about the next 5 or 10 years. And then there's this idea of a terminal value, which is where you capture all the future value after that date. And these terminal values turn out to be really quite important to like the overall value. So just to be specific, if you did Netflix and you're valuing Netflix, you know, they're not generating a ton of free cash flow right now, but in 5 years, the thought is that they will. And that terminal value, which captures all those future cash flows, is where all the value of Netflix today comes. The reason that's a really compelling metaphor to me is because, first, I think, you know, the world does belong to the young and the future is what matters. And in fact, in, you know, my life and in many people's lives, terminal values, the things we leave behind, the things that really are the future, in my case, my children, for other people, maybe their children or their communities or however they perceive the world, is what really, really matters. So that's the sense in which in finance, we look to the future, all value comes from the future. And in fact, terminal values are the most important thing in the world. That is true, I think, for many of us as well. And this, I think, is emblematic of another thing the book is trying to get to, which is these ideas in finance actually are really kind of life-affirming and wonderful, right? So part of the way to rehabilitate finance is to get people in finance to understand these things they do are not just about spreadsheets and screens, but they're about actually moral lessons that are pretty wonderful. So there's moral content in the ideas of finance, as opposed to thinking they're just, you know.
It can be hard to appreciate that, unfortunately, with Squawk Box on and with assets repricing on a daily basis and with no cash flows from many of these investments. That is no tangible way of measuring that terminal value or future value, kind of making it up with some numbers. So the daily repricing of assets in the stock market, at least not all assets are repriced, you know, private assets are not, but I think at least I encounter in trying to apply a similar, not identical, but similar approach as you do in my day job is the near-term noise can get in the way of long-term thinking. Again, when those assets reprice on a daily basis, the temptation is just to try to manage that, not to really think about real or not significant or not significant changes in the terminal values, the long-term trajectories.
Yeah, no, I think as you obviously know well, I mean, the great danger in the investing world is you get lost in a Bloomberg screen and, you know, you're watching flickering prices and it's just a recipe for disaster.
So what are the big issues? It's really reflecting the first couple chapters, but I think it's, and you mentioned it once, but I think it's worth circling back and referencing it again, is kind of not only modern portfolio theory, which is a particular topic of interest to me, but in modern finance in general, the goal of diversification is as the key risk management and effectively return augmentation tool is really central, whether it's MPT, modern portfolio theory, or just how people think about it, even if they're not aware that they're using MPT. Diversification is this, as you characterize and others have as well, this great last free lunch in modern economics. You have a number of examples throughout the book, throughout all the chapters of diversification at work and why it's so central to both academic and practical finance. But I think it's worth coming back to that if you can.
Yeah, sure. And I think, again, this is like options, which is, you know, people think diversification is something that came out of the 1960s in modern portfolio theory. But it's first worth remembering that the basic intuition of diversification is deeply rooted in our brains and in our logic. And it's been operative for, you know, 3,000 years. And so you can trace it back in history from shipping routes and the ways in which people would split up cargo across shipping lines to you know, these remarkable systems of agriculture in early English history, where you would take different strips of land and you would make sure that you had strips of land that weren't next to each other, seemingly in a very uneconomic pattern, but you would be benefiting from the diversification of your exposure to different weather patterns. So diversification is just, it's not something novel. It's not even something that really belongs to finance. It's really something And this is, I guess, another big idea in the book, which is these ideas are rooted in our humanity. They're not just something that finance is imposing on us. These are basic intuitions. And of course, they show up in religious texts, you know, like Ecclesiastes and the Talmud. And then, you know, that diversification ends up having these really neat, I think, you know, logics more generally, which is diversification about how you spend your time and how valuable that is, diversification about how you create a social circle and how valuable, you know, diversity can be. My favorite part, and I think the part that's really weird in the book is about the betas, you know, which is, I think, the biggest stretch in the book in a way is about trying to get the capital asset pricing model intuition through kind of some notion of friendships. And, you know, in short, the implication of diversification is that risk is priced with betas, which are not measures of volatility per se as standalone assets, but as correlations with how you move with the market. And so that basic intuition, which is that high beta stocks, you know, co-move with the market strongly, should have high expected returns and as a consequence, low values. And negative beta stocks, for example, move against the market and correspondingly should have very low expected returns and as a consequence, very high values. That intuition of high beta assets being less valuable and negative beta assets being the most valuable assets in the world, you know, I try to argue translates really nicely to how you think about the relationships in your life that matter. And so here again is an example where the finance logic is actually quite life affirming and kind of wonderful, which is high beta assets can be great and you'll have friends who are high beta assets, you know, like your LinkedIn network or instrumental friendships that you have. They can be the source of great wealth, but don't get confused. They're not the most valuable assets in the world because when you're down on your knees, those people won't be there for you. And conversely, the really, really wonderful valuable assets in the world are the negative expected return assets, the negative beta assets, which is those are the people who are there for you when you're down on your knees. They're the ones who pull you down when you fly too high.
They may not be the flashiest people in the world, but
they're not the flashiest people in the world. And in some sense, you know, they really, that notion of negative covariance of, you know, not just that they're there for you when you're down on your knees, but also that when you ride high, they kind of remind you of how to keep your feet on the ground. That, of course, is the most valuable people in our lives. And we're lucky to have those negative beta assets in our life. And that's kind of the logic of finance, too, which is, and this goes back, I think, Daniel, to the first point, which is one of the wonderful things about writing this book is I had to think hard about these ideas again. And it made me remember how important insurance is, you know, because at the bottom of the capital asset pricing model is the logic of insurance. You know, when you're down on your knees, you need assets to pay off because marginal utility of wealth, to be technical, is high. And that's why you love those assets, right? And that's what gives rise to beta. And that's what the capital asset pricing model is all about. So that's the sense in which insurance is just so, so crucial to modern finance. And, you know, and I think is a powerful frame on our own lives.
Well, one thing, sort of a footnote on the CAPM, the capital asset pricing model, for those who are in finance, this is a paradigm that emerged as a practical way to apply modern portfolio theory, which is created in the 50s, but not in a practical way. And then CAPM emerges in the 60s as a reasonably practical way to bring some of these concepts of risk and return and a spectrum of risk and return and diversification to play. The CAPM itself, though, as a very simple formula, has not fared well the last couple of decades. And it's a very nice metaphor for how you're using it. It is somewhat falling into desuetude, I would argue, even though people use beta in the shorthand fashion that you are all the time as a susceptibility to market movements. The CAPM itself is, with all due respect to the Nobel Prize winning authors of it, is 50 years old and kind of showing it. But I think if it survives, it might well survive in the format that you have, which shows that, you know, all flash and boom is one thing, but those, whether people or investments, those securities may not be around 5 or 10 years from now. It's also hard in the current environment where we've had 10 years of a bull market. People can confuse all of those high beta investments and assume everything's going to be fine because they've been fine for 10 years. We'll see whether that's still the case another 10 years out or whether the Con Eds of this world make a, which is a negative beta investment to pretty much any portfolio, whether they become more appreciated than they have been the past 10 years.
You know, it's interesting. The disrepute of the CAPM that you point out, which of course is right. It's a really fascinating time in finance, right? Because people are discontent with that paradigm. They still use it all the time.
Yes, anyway. Absolutely. Every day. Even the ones when they're saying they're not going to use it will turn around and say, hey, what's your beta?
Even when they're saying how terrible it is, they're using it, right? In some basic way. But, you know, I do worry that these things that are competing to replace it, whether it is some multi-factor model or like, you know, some behavioral thing, you know, they're fine, but they're quite a theoretic, you know, and they don't really have any underlying idea behind it. And so it's a really interesting time in finance because people want solutions, but they seem to be very willing to kind of give up on some idea of what is really driving prices, just to, as long as they can fit the data.
Yeah, it is. It is a, I forget whether it was FAMA or French, saying it's in regard to the CAPM, a sweeping and tour de force theory. I think it's Eugene Fama, a tour de force, theoretical tour de force. Doesn't happen to work, but it is a theoretical tour de force, and it'll probably live on, as you point out, until not only a practical solution comes, but a equally elegant, and it is awfully elegant, an equally elegant theoretical solution. Let's move on to another issue. If we can, feel free to continue on that. But one other thing that I wanted to get to, which is a completely different issue, which you take up nicely and is not keeping me up at night, but I think a great deal about it in based on my job as an institutional investor, is the principal and agent problem of the modern corporation and investing in modern large-scale corporations through the boards of directors and then the hired, what I refer to as the hired help, the CEOs and so forth. You have a wonderful story involving a Tootsie Roll that shows how complex agency problems are in modern finance. And I think that's something that people really need to appreciate when they're investing you know, understand what it means to be a company owner, but a company owner in a modern sense, which means you own a few shares of a large corporation and you sort of have a voice, but you really don't have a voice how the stock market is organized around that.
Yeah, no, I really come to believe that this underlying principal agent problem, which is, you know, the finance talk for this idea that there are people who are ultimate owners, and then they appoint other people to kind of do the work for them, which is what happens when you're building a house or when you go to the doctor or when you go to a lot of different settings. I've really come to believe that that is kind of the defining problem of modern capitalism. And it's what we're struggling with in so many ways, which is just a way of saying 150 years ago, most of us had the privilege of working for ourselves. And that's not, you know, the case today in the sense that ownership and control are separated. And that, of course, started with the observations of Burley and Means 100 years ago. But it's really magnified today. So, you know, if you think about Tim Cook, he's my agent as an owner of Apple, but, you know, he doesn't always take my calls. And so that's the principal agent problem. And in fact, I can't monitor him. And he may do things that I don't like. And I can't quite tell whether he's doing the right thing or not. Of course, it's even more complicated because there are institutional investors who sit between me and Tim Cook. Sometimes layers of them, if you think about funds of funds and pension funds and the whole system of intermediation. The reason that's neat and interesting is because, first off, it just is a way to understand modern capitalism, but it's also, I think, a way to think about your life. So the Tootsie Roll example is nice because it's an example of a CEO who was somewhat, you know, maligned for not taking into account all the interests of their shareholders. And in fact, it was run a little bit more like a family business, in part because the family had a large stake. And when he passed, the stock price went up.
At the age of 95, after 50 years of running the company.
Exactly. And the stock price went up considerably. And in fact, this is a phenomenon which, you know, we observe with some regularity, which is, and by the way, it's like a relatively unexpected death. And what we see with some of these unexpected deaths in finance is that stock prices rise. And that's puzzling to people. But it really underscores what the principal agent problem is, which is, wait a second, I put this person in charge of the company, but now he or she's not doing necessarily what I want. But it's always quite complex, as the Tootsie Roll story is complex. You know, the first time I tell it, he's kind of a bad guy and he's not really doing right by the shareholders. You know, the second time you look a little more deeply into it, it's not clear if he's a bad guy or not. And in fact, he's trying to balance the interests of the family and the community and doing a lot of different things. So the principal agent problem is both this like very powerful frame on modern capitalism, but it doesn't yield simple answers, right? It's not like he's a good guy or a bad guy, or the institutional investors are good guys or bad guys. It's just a really powerful frame to understand that. And I argue in that chapter, you know, a really powerful frame to think about the world more generally. And I think many of us find ourselves in settings where, you know, we've delegated something to an agent, or we find ourselves functioning as agents without even knowing it.
Yeah, the simplest, you know, simple version of this is do your own brain surgery or your own dentistry, or do you have someone else do it? And then when you have someone else do it, you acknowledge that, well, if they're doing it, you know, you've lost some control. That's kind of at a throwaway level, or you know, funny anecdote level. But there's a whole rich academic and practical literature on the implications of agency costs in complex organizations, which is to say large American or modern corporations, and you invest in them, that it's not just a throwaway joke. It's a very serious part of, as you point out, it's kind of critical to modern large scale business.
Yeah. And even, think about what venture capital is, and think about what private equity is, and think about what public markets are. Fundamentally, they're trying to figure out the principal agent problem, right? So in venture capital land, you know, why do you see convertible preferreds? You know, why do you see staged financings? You know, private equity in part is a solution to kind of dispersed ownership by having one big owner, but then they run into their own problems because they have to exit into public markets. And guess what they're going to do to those companies as they sell them out? They're going to make them look, you know, very, very good. And so it's everywhere, you know, and in a way, you know, Daniel, I've come to believe these last 30 or 40 years, you know, what has the big experiment been? It's been with stock-based compensation. And what has that been about? Well, that was motivated by a notion that we're going to solve the principal agent problem, which is owners worrying that managers don't take into account their own interests by loading people up with stock. Now, I personally don't think that that's worked out terribly well. But it's the defining kind of struggle. And it doesn't mean managers are bad or investors are good or anything like that. It just means it's kind of like the hardest problem in the world.
I think that there's also a kind of an argument to be made that it rises and falls. That's the degree to which we trust the board of directors or the managers goes through cycles. And after particularly bad periods, periods of bad behavior, then the calls for greater control can be heard. And when things are working just fine, we'll just let Jeff Bezos be Jeff Bezos and he can do whatever he wants. As a historian, I would harken back. You did made a passing reference to, but I want to call it out to Burl and Means. This whole issue identified, though I don't even think they use these terms, but they created this whole conversation in 1932. This is Adolf Burl and Gardner Means, for those of you with a historical bent, who came out in 1932 with a book on the modern corporation. And it really was the beginning, if you think about the emergence of modern finance, understanding of modern stock markets. This was the first kind of comprehensive account of what a modern corporation is like. And they spend a great deal of time on this understanding that you have an agency problem, even if you don't use that term, because you are a small shareholder for a large corporation, which is controlled by, at that time, the high priests of finance or business, but now it would be considered institutional investors. And your voice is somewhat small, and it can leave the board of directors and the CEOs to have a rather imperial or heightened view of their abilities and take the view of the small investor with little regard. So, you know, it's been 100, literally coming up on 100 year problem, but it's worth going back to the very beginning. They were writing in the shadow of the stock market crash in 1929. And in the 1920s and in the kind of Wild West period in the decades before, modern corporate behavior was demonstrably pretty bad. And so they had something to write about. It's interesting to reread Burl and Means 90 years later and wonder how much has changed.
Well, no, I think that work stands up incredibly well, right? I mean, that book stands up incredibly well. And in fact, you know, the way you framed it, I think is right. I recently, I guess last year now, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about Apple and Google. And I just tried to make the point that in a way, you know, Apple and Google are, what's interesting about that comparison in part is, you know, Apple has just become a cash distribution monster, right? So they've disgorged, you know, $200 billion or more by dividends and buybacks in the last several years. Google, in contrast, has not, while generating comparable levels of cash. And the reason, of course, is that the three people who own and control Google have voting rights, and far in excess of what institutional investors do. So there are two very different takes on the principal agent problem and which principal agent problem is worse, right? So in one sense, if you believe that the real problem is, you know, managers who don't listen to owners, then you like Apple because Apple's disgorging the cash to the owner's benefit. If instead you believe the real problem in life is institutional investors who are responding to short horizons and who aren't doing well by their ultimate shareholders, then you kind of think the Google model might be better. So I think that principal agent frame to me is just explains so much of what's happening in the world today.
And it's the same. It's not covered in your book or in my writings on this issue, but the degree of government regulation is sort of a corollary to this. When you think that these individuals, the directors and the CEOs, are going to behave less well, you might be on the side of greater regulation. If you think that you choose good people and you let them do their jobs, then you would want less government regulation. And that's also kind of this parallel narrative to the principal agent problem, at least in the United States and Europe at the present time.
Yeah, no, I really, and I think then, you know, what I try to do in the chapter is then just try to take it into your life, which I think is actually, you know, that chapter is probably the chapter in the book that is the weirdest because it goes all the way from like, you know, Tim Cook and corporate governance all the way to, you know, Mel Brooks and Sigmund Freud. But that principal agent frame, I think it's a lot of what life is, like trying to figure out when you're a principal, how to become a principal as opposed to, you know, functioning as an agent, which is a way of saying, you know, not functioning to kind of please other people.
So we could go on for hours about that topic. Let's move on a couple more. Let's move on to romance, which was explained very succinctly by Charlie Parker and Tiny Grimes, that you need some finance to make romance work real well. And you circle back to the marriage market, but then very interestingly to a corporate M&A and make a kind of a very non-finance but really interesting notion that, you know, some of these marriages – you whether it's a corporate or a personal one, you have to do the numbers, but also there's something beyond the numbers that, you know, you want to make sure it works well, that the partners are in sync.
Yeah. So I think that is maybe the cheekiest chapter, which is just a way of saying it's titled No Romance Without Finance. And it's meant to kind of take these two worlds, you know, which people tend to take apart and think separately about, which is the world of love and romance, which is wonderful and high-minded and lovely, and things like finance, which is dirty and grungy or something. And in fact, of course, these worlds have been intertwined for, again, centuries. So I kind of talk about marriage market, you know, a little bit about Renaissance Florence, but then up until, you know, recently and continuing to today, marriages have, you know, deep financial logics, and we observe that in the data in all kinds of ways. The more, I think, interesting one is about the mergers, which is a way of saying, we actually know a lot about mergers, and as you know well, it's a pretty checkered pretty checkered history.
The bigger they are, the generally the less successful they are. That's from my
that's one
initial take.
And so, you know, what the chapter tries to do is say, well, look, let's take a look at what we know about mergers and think about how actually it corresponds really well to the folklore around marriages and what guides successful marriages. I use the AOL Time Warner. It's a slightly dated example because it's probably now 20 years old. But it's this classic, you know, romance merger that just went horribly wrong.
I can still remember the probably on television, the scene of the two CEOs coming out, Case and I'm trying to remember his. And he's trying to dress down. One of the Levin was trying to dress down, and Case was trying to dress up because they were two on the stage when they're explaining this, and they looked awfully awkward together.
Yeah, and it was a real kind of shotgun romance, right? Or shotgun marriage, and of course that particular merger manifests a lot of things that we know goes wrong with mergers, and I think with marriages. And you know, a couple of those examples are. You know, synergies are always overestimated, which in merger land, you and I know as people in finance just means, you know, people have these fantastic ideas about the way they're going to be able to change organizations and change their partners very, very quickly and costlessly and painlessly. And that, of course, never turns out to be right. Which I think, of course, has a corresponding language in corresponding logic in marriage as well. Nobody really thinks about integration costs. You know, serial acquirers tend to do really poorly. You know, asymmetric mergers are easy, but not that rewarding. Mergers of equals are really, really tough, but where a lot of value comes from. And so there's a, and then the final, maybe most important one is, you know, the real intuition around mergers, of course, is that execution is everything. And it's just a ton of hard work, which can trump a lot of other things. And of course, I think that applies to marriages as well. So that, and that chapter, and it ends with this really crazy Firestone story, which, you know, it's like one of those stories in American business history that you can't quite believe, you know, happened in the way it did. But it also is a way to kind of bring together these worlds of mergers and marriages.
But you do end up with a successful one. I think the Body by Fisher you view as a successful merger.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, that, and this kind of goes all the way to kind of modern economic theory about, you know, how we think about what two entities belong together and how we should draw, you know, what's technically called the boundaries of the firm. Like, when do two entities belong together and when should they be apart and just contracting with each other? And Fisher Body is this great example. It's kind of like this story in economics, which has become a Rorschach test. You know, like you see everything you can possibly see in economics in that test. And the short version is GM ends up buying Fisher Body slowly, first makes an investment and then ends up buying the whole thing, because they needed Fisher Body to make really specific investments that were conditional on the relationship with GM. And the only way to encourage that investment by Fisher Body was, in fact, to kind of up their commitment levels. And so there's this really nice tie between, you know, the notion of commitment and these relationship-specific investments, which is what that whole modern notion of the theory of the firm is about. And I think, you know, marriages as well.
You know, Boeing had went through a stage where they tried to, the last couple decades, outsource a lot of the production and design of their aircraft, particularly when they're trying to design, you know, entirely new aircraft like the in the 90s, the 80s and 90s, the 777, and then the 787 more recently. And they found all sorts of problems with that. And so they had to then bring in those companies. They had to bring those companies in and, you know, buy them up and bring them back into house because they could not, you know, those companies were not producing products sufficient for their needs.
Yeah. And they would never make the investments necessary to produce those things without a much greater commitment, you know, either some multi-year contract, but ultimately ownership.
Indeed. Let's move on to another topic. Great, you know, also kind of a dirty word, loved on Wall Street. If it were fully understood on Main Street the way it is, and sometimes used on Wall Street, which is leverage, which is taking on debt, it wouldn't be very well received. You have a really quite a different take on leverage, putting it as part of the normal risk and return on the spectrum of risk and return that people need to have some leverage in order to almost achieve great things. I found it an interesting, very interesting chapter.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, you know, so funny because talking about debt today is such a minefield, right? Because people have some very strong views about it. And of course, there are two great misconceptions about debt and leverage. And the first misconception is that it's terrible. But, you know, debt and leverage of all kinds is bad. And then the second misconception about it is once you take it on, it doesn't matter how much you take on, you just, it's all fun and games. And so I worry about both misconceptions because people have become so anti-debt today that they forget how wonderful it can be. And I use the debate between Jeremy Bentham and Adam Smith, you know, Smith, the guy who got a lot of things right, you know, got debt wrong because he thought it was bad. Bentham realized that debt and leverage and credit were so important because they allowed people who didn't have resources to do things. And if you don't have leverage and debt, the only people who get to do things are wealthy people.
Yeah, the whole middle class experiment in home ownership in this country is based on a mortgage. And that's a distinctive element in our society's success.
And it's been fantastic, except when it went to excessive levels, right? And so part of that story is about why people on Wall Street love leverage. And I think the short version is because it gives you the ability to do things you have would have no way to do otherwise. You get to live in a home you have no right to live in. You get to buy an education you have no right to buy. You get to control assets you have no right to control. And that's amazing. I make a parallel to that in life, you know, which is I think it is fundamentally about how commitments to people, to families, to organizations, to people in your life actually opens up experiences that you would never have had otherwise. And then that is the nature of leverage in life. And I think that's enormously powerful. And similarly, when you go overboard, in the case of bankruptcy or debt overhang, you know, when debt becomes such a paralyzing part of your life, which of course is happening to Americans today, then you can make a lot of mistakes. And that is the terrible part about debt overhang. You stop investing in the things that are actually really good investments for you to make because you have the shadow of debt over you. And that's when restructuring your obligations becomes really, really important. And I think that has gotten an analog in life too, which is sometimes all these pre-existing commitments that we've made stop us from being able to kind of think about what the future should hold. And you need to restructure your claims at those times. So that's the sense in which I try to use leverage to kind of elucidate both why it is really wonderful, and also first why it's not for everybody, and then also what you do when you get in trouble with it. The Coons, I do a little bit on Jeff Koons and George Orwell because I really loved the Coons example to manifest somebody who knows leverage. You know, Coons is, you know, a lot of people, he's a very controversial artist, but I think he's one of the great artists of the last 100 years. This is a guy who grew up in finance. And man, does he understand leverage? Like, you know, his whole career is predicated on leverage. He was a cotton futures trader, and he, you know, he uses leverage in many ways. First, he basically gets paid for his work before he does it. He has like 150 people working for him. He doesn't even really know how to use the material he ends up using. He just understands that he needs good people to do it, and then he designs it. This is a highly levered guy, and you know, unsurprisingly, he's gone bankrupt several times and he's bankrupted dealers all the time. But he's pretty fantastic. And, you know, he's got he's kind of, at least according to the Whitney Museum, the greatest American artist, living American artist today. So it's kind of this really great story of a high leverage guy who risks it all and he fails and he goes bankrupt a couple of times. And then he hits it big as well, which is exactly, of course, the story of leverage in American life as well.
So speaking kind of, the quintessential American prairie tune, a prairie story, and so forth. You've got you end your book on a high note, also a success story, not without necessarily all of the ups and downs of Jeff Koons, but a story about Willa Cather, which I think is really an interesting take on trying to end on a high note, where finance, you can see finance in everyday life of people using finance to have successful, satisfied, meaningful lives. And it's a wonderful story. I think we could end on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the last chapter, you know, tries to solve this problem, which is, I just kind of went through 8 or 9 chapters telling you how great finance is. And it's got a terrible reputation. And in fact, in fiction, it's got this really harsh reputation. But there's this great example in fiction of a wonderful person who understands finance, uses it, and lives this incredibly virtuous life. And that's this woman, Alexandra Bergson, in O Pioneers, who, you know, she really, this story really literally belongs like in every finance textbook because she exemplifies all the lessons of finance we've just been talking about. So she manages risk by diversifying. She provides insurance to people. She merges. She uses leverage. It's really kind of a fantastic embodiment of all the things in finance. The great news about it, though, is unlike other literary figures who work in finance, who almost always turn out to be Shkreli-like characters, you know, kind of ugly, arrogant, avaricious people, Bergson turns out to be this wonderful woman, and she's incredibly successful. But she kind of, and I think the best part about it is she understood the central lesson of finance, which so many practitioners forget, you know, which is that a lot of finance is luck, right? And the central intuition of efficient markets and anything approximating efficient markets is it's really hard to tell the difference between luck and skill. And in fact, we should probably presume that a lot of success is luck rather than skill. And Bergson kind of gets this idea. And as a result, you know, she doesn't turn into a jerk despite her success. In part, what I observe in the world, at least, is there are people in finance who, because of the leverage and because of the speed with which wealth is created and destroyed, who kind of over-amplify their own impact on their success. And it's for good reason, because you got to make sense of your success. And, you know, the easiest way to do that is to attribute it to yourself. But Bergson's a cautionary tale about how powerful it can be to remember that in finance, it's really hard to tell the difference between luck and skill. Mm-hmm. And over the long run, maybe we know who's really lucky and who's really skillful, but you don't know until, 30 or 40 years into the game.
Indeed. Well, that's an excellent way to finish up. Professor Desai, thank you so much for sharing with us sort of the nuggets from the Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. It is, as I said in the introduction, an excellent bridging of the gap between two worlds that need to understand each other better. There's a lot of that in the world these days of effort to need to understand each other better. Can you also comment on your next project, which people might be interested in?
Sure. So I have a book actually coming out in March with HBR Press called How Finance Works, which is a kind of more traditionally pedagogic book, which I'm really excited about. I'll mention just two other quick things. We recently launched a podcast of our own, which is really fun. It's called After Hours. So myself and two colleagues at HBS do a talk on what's going on in business and society. And then the new book, Daniel, I'd love to talk to you about at some point, which is it's about the rise of investors. And that's what I'm working on now. So I'd love to maybe I can bend your ear about it at some point.
Indeed. In the meantime, both The Wisdom of Finance is available through normal book channels, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and so forth, and How Finance Works, the HBR Guide, is also available for pre-order through those same channels. Professor Desai, thank you so much for sharing your time and insights with us.
My pleasure. It was really fun to talk to you.
Take care.